Okay, today I'm in the Racing Post offices with Ross Brierley. Thanks very much for agreeing to talk to me today, Ross. Come down from Leeds, especially. Racing journalist, broadcaster, previously a professional punter, still I assume a successful punter, and stand-up comedian. Now that last one's a bit of a wild card in this little Yankee, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a bit, yeah. I think it kind of is and it isn't. I mean, it is in the way that it's very different from the others in terms of industry, but in terms of trying to do something a little bit different, maybe, I think it probably ties into it. Just trying not to have a normal job since I left university, I think it fits in with that.
Yeah. So which one would best describe you at the moment? I mean, it's what of that lot, which is your main...
Good question. This is the problem I often have, is I kind of just have to describe myself as a jack of all trades, really. And my missus was taken to calling me a horse personality when people asked what I did. I used to say I was an equine investor, so people wouldn't pick up on the word gambler. But yeah, a bit of everything. I mean, I haven't actually done a comedy gig for about, well, just over a year now, but I did that for 10 or 11 years. And like I said, the punting is no longer, that used to be a good chunk of my income. So now I guess probably, yeah, racing broadcaster probably covers it. Yeah. Content creator. We're all content creators now, Simon, aren't we?
We are. So when we were talking about this before, you said that you'd no longer call yourself a professional punter, but you also told me that you won enough in your time to buy and renovate a house. So by anybody's standards, that's pretty successful.
Yeah, I had a good... Well, so what? Yeah, so I guess... Yeah, 2011, I went freelance. And basically, I had a right old bet come in. I was working at William Hill Radio at the time, sort of full-time. I started there after uni. Gone to uni, journalism degree. Didn't really know what I was going to do. Thought I was going to go off and be a proper journalist. Covering big stories and everything, but then got a job at William Hill in the call centre. And part of that, it was like 2 or 3 weeks training course. You need to know everything so that when someone rings up and says, can I have a 50p Union Jack at Perth? You're not asking, what the hell are you talking about, mate? You can just go straight into it. So we learned everything. And then we obviously spent all day, whenever I was doing shifts, you'd watch football, you'd watch horse racing, and you get the Racing Post, and I was just absolutely fascinated by it. So then after uni, I kind of got some work experience. Basically, I turned up until they gave me a job and then learned everything. I had podcasts, presenting, punditing. And then 2011 got to the point where I thought, well, I'm doing this job about as well as everyone who's doing it professionally and sort of freelance. And then, yeah, won about a year's wages in a day and thought, okay, this is the chance to...
So how did you win it?
It was three horses. It was Sans Frontier at Newmarket with the July Festival. It was a horse called Poppet's Lovin' at Warwick, and a horse called Hairspray at Epsom. That one was in the 9:10 at Epsom, and the other two were about 3 p.m. in the afternoon. So it was a long 6 hours. I also got the place pot paid bombs at Newmarket that day as well, and backed them all individually, and they all won. I think on the early prices, they were sort of 16s, 11s and 12s, I think, or something like that. And yeah, it basically all came off. And I just thought, I'd been meaning to, right, let's use this. You know, when you're young and you've got no responsibilities, you can take those risks. So I thought, right, okay, let's do this. And I basically went into, yeah, the office of my boss at the time, William Hill Radio, and said, I want to do this. And he went, how has it taken you so long? I thought you'd be in the day you won it, kind of thing. And then, yeah, I've been freelance ever since. So, and then from about 2011, I'd say up to sort of just before the pandemic, I'd say the punting was normally between 30 and 80% of my income the year. On a good year, you know, it was right up there. But yeah, it was all that one bet. So I think it was about 37, 38 grand on the day. And I just thought, well, that's tax-free. Worst comes to worst is I come crawling back with my tail between my legs a year later and go, can I have my job back, please? So
what was your angle that day? I mean, how were you coming up with your selections? And were you doing like multiples on a regular basis up until then?
Well, I mean, again, I don't want to be one of those people who, having watched quite a few of these, a lot of the comments are another person coming on saying the game's gone and all that. But obviously the edges that I was using at the time were probably a bit easier to exploit. Speed figures in particular. I mean, you can go online and within 2 minutes you can pay for top quality speed figures or get them for free anyway. Back in those days, it wasn't that easy. And also, you know, like I said, you can watch videos on you can go on the Racing Post app now. This sounds like a plug because I'm in the offices. Like, you can go on the Racing Post app. And you can watch.
Who's a comedian?
Yeah, that's it. I don't know if you. You can see it never leaves you though. It's like riding a bike. You can go online right now and you can watch back replays of literally every single British and Irish video. You don't have to race. You can watch it time and time again. Again, it was just if you put the work in, you could get an edge. And there was a few. So Sam Frontier had run in the Hardwick Stakes at Ascot, and it was a fantastic renewal. The speed figure was out of this world. It was a really eye-catching race. And it was, I could not believe it was double. It was dead 8-9 runners. It was double figures. And I think it was a classic race of one of Bally Doyle's being, this is their ledger horse or whatever it is, and that taking chunks out of the market. And it was just a daft price. And I just knew that Hardwick was good form. And Poppets Lovin' had similarly come out of a couple of really good races. It was just top on the figures with two runs, really eye-catching runs. And again, was sort of 8-9 runners, double figures. And I thought, well, this is just a great bet. And then Hairspray had spotted running beforehand at Leicester and thought that was a big eye-catching run. I love a horse with an eye-catching return to action, mid-division, you know, not handbrake on necessarily, but one where you think, oh, okay, that's going to really improve next time out. And everything just looked right, and it was at Epsom. Chris Catlin was rode Epsom really well. Again, Shannon trained it. It was another one of those Shannon horses that people think, your Shannon's, your Fahies of this world. Because they run 7, 8, 9, 10 times a year, people don't take the time to wash them back and dig into the form lines. So I think they're often good mm-hmm. angles as well, the slightly more exposed trainer. So yeah, it was speed figures and video analysis, and it just happened to come off on the day, and I thought, all right, this is a sign.
Okay, now you're a disciple of Nick Morden and Andrew Bayer, is that the pronunciation of Bayer?
I think it's Bayer figures, yeah. Well, again, it was one of those things that, like, I mean, Nick Morden is, I don't know what Nick's doing now.
Apparently he's in Hong Kong, and I've been trying to track him down.
Really?
Yes, but I've not managed it yet. Hence the
Nick, you need to do.
But he would be good. I mean, why do you?
Simon, I'm just sorry. Oh, you, Nick. Simon, you need to go and talk to Nick and do that because I used to his pieces in the Weekender, where he would take a wild theory and follow it to the ends of the earth, were fantastic. And you know, yeah, Morden on time and Bayer on speed. When you're just getting into something, they felt like holy grails. They felt like someone had written something that let you into a secret. And it just made so much sense at the time. I was like, oh yeah, I'm trying to predict winners of races and I'm using every other factor in the book apart from the actual time of the race. And again, like, I mean, I'm recycling that line in the column that I sent you, but it is like, you know, you wouldn't be like, what a fantastic performance in the 100 metres, and people would be like, but we don't know how quick he's gone and we've got no comparison. So I was remember reading that and thinking, oh, well, me and a friend at the time were like, well, we'll give it a crack, we'll try and make our own figures. And so my email address includes the horse Reverence in my email address because he was the first one. We started doing them, and the back end of that first year, Reverence for Eric Alston won a Doncaster soft ground handicap in a tie. Like, we were like getting into it, like, wow, this is it, this is a fantastic speed figure. And then went and won Nonthorpes and Sprint Cups in bad ground, and he was like the first one that we latched onto, which really paid his way. and made us think, okay, this is the angle. So yeah, but those two books, even now, there is so much good information and good learning in there, and just fascinating angles, because that's what you're always looking for in the game. You are, doesn't matter what the angle is, you're looking for something where someone else, the best angle in the world is when someone goes, nah, it's nonsense, mate. And then you go, okay, it might be nonsense or it might be genius.
And it's also video analysis you concentrate on.
Yeah, I think that's huge. I think that's absolutely huge. Again, I think you've got every race at your fingertips, and while every horse is doing their best, should we say, in theory, you can just learn so much from going back and watching a race. In the moment, you probably have the narrative of the race in your head, and you might have backed one, you're probably watching the one you've backed, you maybe might be watching the favourite if it's a high-profile horse. The commentator might have said, oh, they've got a right clip here or something. There's all that information in your head that you're watching that race, and it is biased towards your interpretation of that race in the moment. But if you can take the time with a bit of the dust settling and go back and watch it and go, did they go that quick? Or, oh, maybe he didn't run that badly, actually. Maybe, or again, I mean, it's funny, isn't it? You can remember the moments that you pick up on something that kind of stick with you. And like, I distinctly remember a novice hurdler called Amore Mio for Emma Lavelle. It didn't even win, but I backed it each way at 33-1, gave the odds on favourite a cracking run, finished second. But the main reason I backed it, one, it had done a good figure, but two, if you watch a video back of its race, nobody mentioned that it made a shocking mistake halfway around, almost brings it to a standstill, runs on, really eye-catching. But again, people weren't doing eye-catcher columns. People weren't using horse track as their front and centre. I remember thinking, oh, okay, I've spotted something that somebody else hasn't because I've been bothered to go and play the replay back and specifically looking at this horse that I half fancy. And I think that's still an edge. That's still a massive edge. And I think people... it takes a long time, doesn't it? So that's partly why people don't do it.
Is it because most people will look at the race readers, the comments, or listen to the commentary and take that as gospel?
Yeah.
Rather than actually see if they're right, because it's one person's opinion, isn't it?
Well, and that's it, isn't it? I think you've got to remember, even, you know, the betting markets is a collection of opinions. The race comments are a collection of opinions. Every tipster's got their own opinion. The trainer will have an opinion. The jockey will have an opinion. The breeder will have an opinion. I might have an opinion in a chase, and it'll be a very different opinion to someone who follows chases all year. And sometimes mine might be better because I'm approaching it fresh. So, but you're right, there's people's opinions and they're locked in. And like you said, commentary.
Close-up comments.
But also what people will do is they will use the memory that they had of that race when they watched it live, and they won't go back and check it. And, you know, I'm no psychologist or scientist, but there's been enough studies to suggest that memory is pretty unreliable. I think it pays to go back and go, actually, you know what? I'm going to go back. What is my opinion on this horse or this race? Write the opinion down, go back, check if you're right in the cold light of day. But it is the most time-consuming part of it, and that's probably why people don't do it as much.
Okay, Ross, so, you know, we talked previously about your wins, and everybody loves hearing about other people's wins after they've won, all that sort of stuff. But
do they? Do they, Simon? I can tell you about the bad days if you like as well.
What makes a good... You've talked about it in the previous part. What makes a good race reader? I mean, you know, is it because you go into it with an open mind? Is that what makes a good race reader?
It's boring, but what probably makes me a good race reader is having watched tens of thousands of races. It's always dull, isn't it? That the way to get good at something is to just do it a lot. But I know the Malcolm Gladwell thing is a bit cliche nowadays, but that 10,000 hours thing, but that deliberate practice, I think that's the thing. Like trying to go back and learn this kind of stuff? For example, if you're watching a video back, like this is a really quick shortcut, I think, and someone will probably come on and say, you know, there's always one person who will come on and say that's absolutely
all interaction's good. We encourage interaction.
All right. So yeah, come on. Yeah. No. Oh yeah, absolutely. And I will reply to those comments as well. We'll maybe get back onto that when we're talking about in the know later on. I agree. All interaction is good. Otherwise, what's the point in doing this? The start and the end of the race are absolutely crucial. And I think everyone watches the end of the race and ignores what happens at the start. So, and I think a lot of the time, if you're in a rush, a really quick way to watch a race back, I think, and read a race is to just see where they started out, see where they finished, and just be and work out, well, you know, if the first three home were the first three jumping out of the boxes, then you know that the speed was favoured. And anything that comes off the speed is worth watching. But everyone watches the eye catchers coming from the back. And I think the real value is in a lot of the time in the races where the front runner should finish 10th and keeps plugging on for 4th or 5th. But people don't look at that because they see the one weaving a passage through the back. But you're basically, you need to know, you're telling a story, each race is a story. And you need the backstory, such as, you know, draw bias, ground, the form of the horses coming into it.
Would you take the market into account? If somebody drifted from 5 to 10, you'd expect it maybe not to run up to its best. Would you take that into consideration?
I wouldn't take drifters into account, but I do take horses running poorly when the market's very positive into account, and then trying to understand if there's a reason. Especially for, I mean, there's loads of, like, you know, good bumper horses in novice hurdles who go, they'll go 4-1 on debut, get beaten 7th, and everyone will go, they're no good. And you know that they're going to pop up in a handicap in time, but people have forgot. 2-year-olds going off 6-4, 7-4. Or recently, like, the worst bet in the world is a 3-year-old handicap debutant who's not placed, finished 5th, 6th, 7th in the qualifying runs. And everyone says this is thrown in. And it'll go off 6-4. There was one last night at Chelmsford. It'll go off 6-4. It'll get beat. And everyone will go, oh, we were wrong. And you weren't wrong. It's just a massive leap from mid-division and a novice to winning a handicap first time out. And that horse will win. You just need to keep the faith and find when it'll win. But you need to take all that into account. So people will look at that. Your average punter who's just popped into the shop to have a bet at Chelmsford will go, wow. I thought I was thrown in. It's finished 4th. It's run no sort of race. But it's such a, it's an almost impossible leap. And when a horse actually makes that leap, you know you're onto a good one. But follow that horse. Keep an eye on it. The market told you this horse was fancied. It didn't work out today. This horse might run 7, 8, 9 times this season. You only need to be on it a couple of times when it's right. Like, if it didn't work out today, fine. But watching those races back, I think, is key. I think it's absolutely crucial. Making notes next to horses who run against the weight, the story of the race. If the pace held up, did something come from the back? Make a note. If the pace collapsed, who hung about the longest? Make a note. If a horse went all the way down the inside at Ponte and got the dream run down the rail and bolted up by 5 lengths, put something by it saying everything went right. Don't take it. It's those things. And then when you come back to them in 3 weeks, you'll go, oh yeah, you know, I remember that. And once you get that, you start to get almost like an encyclopedia of horses that were advantage or disadvantage. And that's where you find your angles, I think.
Okay, now, speed figures. You tell me that people misunderstand them. Something that I don't understand is if a horse runs a fast time at somewhere like Beverley, and then there was a famous case last year where there was a bit of controversy, it was running at Royal Ascot somewhere,
yeah.
Didn't pan out for the speed figure. So when is a speed figure a good speed figure and when isn't it?
When is it? Yeah. It's a good question. It's the holy grail, mate. I think a lot of speed figures can be used as blunt instruments. They can be like, this horse ran a good figure, therefore it will run a good figure again and again and again. for me, it's just another tool in your arsenal. It, for me, it is 100% the most important tool, personally, when I'm betting, mainly on the races that I bet on. It may be not as important in, I don't know, handicap chasers, for example, where mistakes come into it more, or jumping ability, but it is an indicator of a horse's raw ability, especially in maidens and novices, I think. So if, I can't remember the horse, it was George Bowie or Alan Haynes, wasn't it? White and green silks, my brain's completely gone, but it ran in the Coventry, maybe?
I can't remember, my brain's gone too.
Yeah.
I've got to write your name down.
Yeah. So yeah, but this is the other thing, 10 years ago, I would have been able to tell you that horse, the figure it did, the owner, every race it ran in. You just get old, don't you? You forget these things. So you've got to understand when that figure's going to be replicated. So for example, that was a debutant figure, I think, and I think debutant figures are, it's hard to follow them up, because I think a horse runs its absolute face off on debut, doesn't learn a great deal, goes to Royal Ascot, completely different experience. You know, you're going from corrugated iron at Ripon to running up that hill at Ascot. And it's like driving a Porsche through a muddy field, you know, it's what's right for those conditions aren't necessarily right on the day. So I think the speed figure is a number that tells you this, how well this horse has run. And when you've got winning novices and maidens, that tells you how good is this horse. And again, just keep that information in mind. For example, I love two-year-old group races and listed races, because what happens is those horses then run up against each other, and often I'll just ignore all the subsequent runs and I'll go, who's got the most raw ability based on their novice or maiden win? They might have been beaten into fifth next time out in a group three. This horse might have won a listed race, because people will take the black type runs as gospel, whereas I think that first win is where you really see, how good is this horse? And like you said, yeah, if a horse does a fantastic figure over 6 furlongs and good to firm at Ripon, anyone who's expecting that horse to replicate it over 7 in heavy at Newbury is barking at the wrong tree. But that's what, if you get, you know, I can go on right now and I'll tell you, I can sort by ground, I can sort by trip, I can sort by everything, and you can say, okay, it's 6 furlongs on soft ground today, this horse has the, on numbers, the best chance. So I think it's about using them in the right time. It's about working out how that figure was achieved and how it can be replicated in the future. Whereas a lot of people will go, that was a really fast time, and expect that to copy and paste every next run.
Okay, now you told me that you prefer 2-year-old and 3-year-old races over 6 to 10 furlongs on the flat. So that's fairly specialised. Why? Is that to do with the times again?
Well, it's to do with, I mean, it's an edge, isn't it? It's a specialism, and I think that's what, you know, some people will love. I know someone who loves staying handicap chasers, and maybe it's because I have ADHD. I can't get to the end of a replay of a handicap chase without getting distracted. So if it's a 90-second one, I'm fine. But I think, personally, I think the most important thing is finding something where you've got enough information to have to get an opinion, but the market doesn't have all the information. So, and you also don't want to, 5 furlong sprints are a bit of a lottery. You go over longer distances, the pace can be unreliable. Today at Sandown, we're recording this on the Friday of the 2-day meeting at Sandown. It's kind of one of my favourite days. I love a 3-roll race at Sandown, for example, because Sandown, Newbury, Newmarket, York, you know, give me the 3 Ascot, 3-roll races there, because I think you know how good the horses are, but there's still improvement in them. There's still juice in the market. And that's where you still can get your edge. You can find a bit of an angle.
Okay, now talking of angles, you produce your own speed figures for the flat. So, I mean, is that literally a case of sitting there with your stopwatch?
No, it's just a lot of spreadsheets. I actually pay someone else to input the data because it's so time intensive. And again, I think my edge is interpreting the numbers and then I'm attaching them to video analysis. So the quicker I can get that number in the system is better. But yeah, it's basically, you know, you're taking the times of the race, you're putting them into specific spreadsheets for each race course with our own standard times, and then you're adjusting for class and time of year, two-year-olds, three-year-olds, fillies races or not. And then, you know, you'll adjust it depending if there's a race that was particularly slowly run. You know, you treat that, take that out of the equation, and that gives you a decent judge of the numbers. And yeah, I mean, that laptop there is basically just full of years and years of spreadsheets.
Okay, now, so you do your own flat figures, but you use Andy Holdings, great judge, previous interviewee, for the ratings for the jump. So why don't you create your own? Because a lot of people will be taking notice of what Andy Holdings says already. So your edge is a little bit eliminated there.
Well, that is true. And we're very good friends, Andy. I've known him for nearly 20 years now, and I've never told him this, but I am a little bit annoyed with him for putting his figures online. they're really good. But again, I think the key is interpreting them. So Andy produced, using Andy's basically saves me that jump to actually getting them in the system. But you're right. What would have been a 4-to-1 shot a few years ago is now a 2-to-1 shot a lot of the time if Andy's giving it a good talk up and it's on the numbers. But it's, yeah. I mean, I prefer flat to jump, so I don't think I'd have the interest to do all the jumps figures. And they are just very good. I mean, he did tell me on the phone jokingly to plug his numbers, but I said, I don't need to plug them.
Has he given you the secret ingredient?
No. I don't see how the sausage is made. Put it that way.
So he's kept something close to his chest.
Well,
the actual methodology behind it.
Well, yeah, that's interesting. Methodology, yeah. Which I think was a Mark Johnson, 2-year-old now. So it's interesting because I think my numbers are better. The flat numbers are more reliable than his flat numbers, a little bit. And I've never actually sat down and said, "What are you doing that I'm not?" And everyone, you can adjust the numbers to, you know, people will take weight into account, for example, which I think is absolute codswallop. You know, 4 pounds on a horse. If I was running against Usain Bolt and he was carrying a couple of bags of sugar, you could give him all the sugar in the world and he'd still beat me. So I think class is the big thing there. But no, he's not told me how the sausage are made. But he does regularly, we do regularly have chats where he goes, "Oh, this horse did so-and-so off the bend at Wolverhampton." And I'll just go, "Just remind me again, that's good, right, mate?" Because you do, I'm using your stuff. So you just tell me if that closing section was great, because I can't see your spreadsheet.
Okay, Ross. And it, once again, this is not to tempt all the people that like to put trumpets up on the social media but after timing, but
yeah,
you have had good wins on scoop sixes and place pots, and you do enjoy profitable tote place bets. So what's your strategy on them?
Well, the place bets are more exchange place bets, I think. The place markets, I do like the place markets. And you're right, I did win the scoop six in 2016, and I have had so many painful bad beats since then that I've probably given that win back.
It's gone though, isn't it, now, the scoop six, really? Because Mountie used to do it on a regular basis, and it's...
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think the industry is missing the biggest trick. I think it's absolutely daft, because I think pool betting... Look, we all want extra value, and you all want to bet against each other, and you all want... There's too much racing, for a start. If we had less racing, better quality racing, better pool betting, and we could all go up against each other without it being spread so thinly, this game would be significantly healthier. And if every single Saturday you knew there was a big pot to be chased, people would watch. The viewing figures would go up, betting numbers would go up, and you'd do it without people... I'm not saying you can't display problem gambling behaviours with pool betting as well, but it gives people... It gives your average punter a chance to get involved in something a bit bigger. It has gone a bit. The world pool, I think, with play spots and jackpots and stuff, has made a big difference. I mean, or certain meetings, like Newmarket last week, that three-day meeting, you know, there was 100, 150 grand in the play spot pool. You've just got to have that bet because there's normally 25, 30 in it. So you know you're getting a chance. I mean, the first day at Newmarket last week paid 9 grand. And then it was like 1600 and 500. And again, because of the numbers in there, you there's just huge value. You've got to have a go at it. But it is painful. It is painful because, yeah, the win was good. But like, for example, there was, when was it? It was when Baybridge, the painful one still comes to mind, but when Baybridge won the handicap at York, a couple of years ago, back end of the season, it was Newmarket as well, and I can't show. I wish we could edit in now the replay of the final race, as I had two lines going into the final race.
All sorts of trouble with media rights if we do stuff like
that. Yeah, no chance. Put it this way: I had two that kicked a length clear of the rest, and one came out of the pack and did both of them on the line. And I made a noise like someone had shot a cat. And so, yeah, it's a fantastic bet, but when you're lengthening that, you know, you back one each way and it finishes fourth, it's painful 5 minutes. A whole afternoon to get to the last leg to get chin on the line, it can be quite painful. It can drive you a bit mad.
Okay, talking about getting chinned on the line, you've had some success betting running.
Yeah, I used to do that a lot. Yeah, that was probably my main source of income for quite a few years.
What, you were in sort of Canary Wharf or something like that?
Not quite as glamorous. I was in a porter cabin above a bookies in Bramley in Leeds. It wasn't Canary Wharf.
As long as you had the fast pitches, it didn't really matter, did it?
Exactly, the fast connection. Yeah. And it was odd. I used to drive over to a porter cabin in Bramley and sit in there with four or five other blokes and then drive home after 4 hours. But yeah, it was, again, it is much harder these days. You know, when you had your Turf TV and your SIS and stuff, you used to be able to go in and, yeah, make a good daily wage from it.
Were you a grinder, or you know, a tapper at the end there, making the most of the fast pitches, or were you speculating in mid race, or what was your game?
How did people do? How do people? The 101 bashers. I mean, I salute you. Fair play to you.
Well, but I mean, back then, you 101, it had won, didn't it?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. But I got in slightly after that. I would go into the port cabin, and there was a couple of guys sat in there, and one of them in particular said, you know, you should have been here 5 years ago, mate. We were back in 105s, and they were weighing in. That's like, oh great! He's like, oh, we made millions. Yeah, exactly. That. And I was like, oh right, okay. Well, I'm pretty happy with my 5-2 win, and I've just managed to grind out at Ballinrobe or whatever. No, it was again. I've always been a backer, not a layer, not a grinder, not a trader. It was about doing the figures, doing the video analysis, and then when I thought what was happening in front of me was what I thought was going to happen, getting stuck in, basically, which made for some big swings. That's part of the issue. I don't really do it anymore. You get older, and you coming home to your genuinely coming home to your fiance and saying, and she's like, how was your day? And you're like, oh, I've lost 3 grand. Is gets harder. It gets harder and harder.
First rule of betting, never.
Yeah, exactly. You're right. Yeah, but I never subscribed to that. I was probably too honest with it. And it's a weird, it was okay when you were in the trading rooms and stuff, but now people used to go to the track and whatnot and so forth. But now, you know, if you're sat at home for 5 hours, especially post-lockdown as well, I think that definitely changed my mindset. I just realised I didn't want to be sat in a room on my own anymore. And that for the sake of a few grand, like it's...
What, a day, a week, a month?
Oh, no, I mean, like, as in, like... Look, I'm going to be very clear. Like, you know, there's people I know, like, there's people who have made millions on that, on Betfair, and that wasn't me. If in my head, it was like, if I can make the living I would make normally, tax-free, and I have to work 3 hours a day in the afternoon, I'm happy with that.
Yeah.
I don't want to... You know, there used to be... The guy I respected the most was the guy who came in, and when he won the grand, he went home. And I remember coming in one day, he sat down for the first race. He backed the winner of the first race and he stood up and he packed up his stuff and he went, see you later, lads. And he walked out the door. And I was like, what was that? And he was like, oh, he's won his grand, he's off.
Not necessarily any logic to that, though, is there?
No, not at all. But I think his policy was that, oh, look, this is it was about making money. It was about making a living. It was about feeding his family, so that and he was going to go home and
enjoy the rest of his day.
Yeah, he was going to go have a game of golf instead of sticking around to the 5 o'clock. And what would often happen is you'd make a grand in the first race. You go, oh, I'm on for a right day here. By the 5 p.m., you'd have made 995, and you go, I've just spent 5 hours losing 5 quid.
Yeah. So you were doing, you've talked at the first part about you were a very successful punter at one point. You were very successful at betting and running. Have all those ships sailed? I mean, could you replicate that? I mean, would there ever be a time where you think, where you thought I could go back and purely bet for a living?
Yeah, and no.
The practicalities of just getting your bets on would be a... The biggest logistical problem, from what everybody tells me, that wins.
There's loads of things that go into it. It used to be that I would say to my mate, could you open a few accounts for me?
Get go to prison for that these days.
Well, that's what I mean. And he'd go, yeah, and he'd do it. And he'd pass me the logins, and I'd say, you know, you have 5%, and whatever I win, you can have a bit of it, and it will be fine. That doesn't work anymore. It doesn't work in any capacity. I mean, I've known people who've had, like, you know, mortgage applications turned down because they said, you've had a bet. And these aren't people who bet a lot. There's a stigma in general around it that has heightened. So getting a bet on, even... Like I said, so when I bought my house, I mean, you know, the going in and saying, where did your deposit come from? I'm like, do you know Betfair? was a weird one. But now that would never happen. I would never, ever. I think they would laugh me out of the bank if I had to go back and do that now. So there's that. And it is a grind. It's harder. The juice isn't necessarily worth the squeeze. And I think it is still for some people, and people have their own angles. And I've done the money on the drones, and it is remarkable. And if everyone had access to that, I think it would level the playing field again, and we'd all be off. But you're up against the best of the best in that at the moment, and you just have to be on it all the time. And I just enjoy the other stuff more now, I think. And I also, what used to happen as well is, for example, William Hill Radio, be in the studio with other people. You'd do, you know, I'm doing the Know Tonight, there'd be me and Keels in the studio. You'd have two people on Skype. I'll be recording interviews at home. I mean, this is a genuine. I think I'll probably watch this back and think, bloody hell, calm down, mate. But do you know, it is quite rare to do this stuff in person nowadays. Mm. So I used to be able to do my study in the morning, and I'd either go into the training room and essentially spend the afternoon with colleagues, or you go into William O Radio and spend it with colleagues, or you go to the races and do something there. And then it gets to the point where I prefer that. I want to be interacting with people, and it's a lot more enjoyable. And you still do the work and do the knowledge, but like I said, but you're not having those. It's not all your eggs aren't all in the one basket.
So you're doing the work, but you're using that for the punditry, yep, as opposed to the punting.
Yeah, and I'm still doing the punting, but it used to be. It did used to be easier, and I used to care about it more. But it's all consuming, isn't it? It's especially during the summer. Like, you know, if you have to keep up with it, because you make a mistake. There's no other job where if you make a mistake, you get yesterday's wages taken off you. And yeah, it used to be, you know, when I was younger and single and less responsibilities, it was a lot easier to do that. And it does take, yeah, it's hard. It is hard. It genuinely is hard. I always remember someone saying it was the hardest way to make an easy living. Yeah.
And you're still doing the William Hill Radio.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's every day, all day, not for you, but it's broadcast every day,
yeah,
via the app, isn't it?
Yeah, so that's been going for 20 or 25 years now. And I still think, I mean, the fact that I think it's both the past and the future in a weird way. Because I think, again, I do think, they say it's a game of opinions, right? And everyone wants to share those opinions. It's a social thing. I saw Willie Mullins the other day being interviewed and saying that the social aspect of the game is way underrated. And I still think that's true. And that is partly in person. It is partly going to the races. It's partly that kind of thing. But it's also watching the TV or being down the pub with your mates and discussing, oh, what have you backed, and getting involved in people's wins and losses and opinions. And how can you say that? You know, it was a crap race he won, and he'll never win a grade one, and you're, oh, I don't know, you know. That's the kind of thing. And I think what I like about the radio is working with people I respect who are doing the work I'm doing and going head-to-head with them. And
like, well, bouncing ideas off each other, even.
Absolutely, yeah. And again, like, it's why would you spend 6 hours on Proform in the morning when you can just ask Andrew Mount? Or
which is why I don't delve into the form book.
Yeah. But like, for example, I work with the people, like, I think, like, saying things out loud, saying your opinions out loud or writing them down or bouncing them with someone else, it tests them again. If you say something, it tests it. And I love doing that. And I like, you know, I don't know, maybe you're probably asking me about this in a second, but all the stuff I do at the moment, the stuff I enjoy the most is where you are bouncing off other people. I think that's a post-COVID thing as well. It was definitely noticeable. You're like, oh, isn't it nice to talk to people?
Okay, Ross, like I said, we're in the Racing Post offices at the minute for the reason being that you've timed it. You were down here from Leeds, where you live, to do In the Know with Paul Keighley and Tom Sigal. Mm. So two very shrewd men there. Three very shrewd men. So, you know, tell us a bit about that for people that haven't watched it.
See, but that's the joy you picked up on. What the joy is that when I first started doing it, so it's big festivals, Friday nights. Basically, yeah, it's essentially a betting preview show, but part of it is, you know, getting to absolute veterans of the game, you know, people like your Keels and your Seagulls who have done, again, if I've watched tens of thousands of races, they've watched twice as much, and kind of putting them to the test, and I love it. I think it's really good. Again, I come away from that thinking, God, we should do this all the time. And then Keel says, speak for yourself, mate, I've got loads of copy to write. still never met Tom Sigal, though. I've worked with him for 3 years and I've never actually met him in person.
Wouldn't do an interview either.
I mean, he won't leave the house.
So I'll go to him, but he still won't do it.
No, I'll try and convince him. He won't come in. It's really good. Again, the interaction is fantastic. That's the big thing I love. It's not about, you can watch it and disagree with everything we say and go and place your own bets, and that's half the fun. People get involved in the chat. The comments are really good. I'll go on and reply to the comments. People will think that we're slagging me off and I wasn't going to read it, but then I go and reply to them and they go, love the show, really. It's quite funny. It's amazing. People say don't read the comments, but you should just reply to them nicely. Sort some right out. It's really good. So I'm in there to do that. So me and Keels have been there. It's weird. I've generally spent more time with them than my closest family over the past few years. So Keels doesn't like me calling him Uncle Keels because he says he's not old enough to be my uncle, but it still does feel like that. So yeah, but that's been going for a few years now. It's just, again, I like bouncing the ideas off each other. It's really good.
And the other thing you do is race share.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a relatively recent one. Which is a new microshare syndicate. I've been going about 18 months. And basically, I kind of had one of these conversations with, I mean, he's on the website, he won't mind, but Patrick Veitch, who we've obviously done a very good interview with.
And a follow-up questions and answers.
I've watched them. I've definitely watched them. We had a conversation once and I was talking about content and I was saying that horse racing is 10 years behind everything else because it is online content-wise. What you're doing right now should be, when other sports are doing this times 10, and racing's still a bit, I feel like a lot of people in racing are still a bit like, yeah, but the internet, it's a fad, isn't it? Do you know what I mean? I feel a bit like people are still like, think it's going to disappear. So the point of ratio was that I was a bit skeptical because I've heard people be a bit weird about microshare syndicates because, well, you're buying a horse for this and you're syndicating it for that. But I've owned horses. I've owned two or three horses where I've had like 50, 25% share in them. And it costs us a lot of money. And we didn't get the access that you get if you join a microshare syndicate. But the point was to try and do things. So we do a live stream when people can't get to the races. So you've got that community. But you get economies of scale. Your average racing fan can't afford to buy an 80 grand handicap away Andrew Balding and go and visit the horse three times a year. I was genuinely a bit like, okay, I'm not sure this is my thing. But then when we actually got into it, I was like, this is actually fantastic. And it is honestly the most positive experience I've had in racing, working in racing, because everyone loves it. You turn up at the stable visits, racing needs to get more of this. It needs to get people to go and see the horses, take people to the stables, because they're magical places. And the horses are incredible animals. And they're, like, I'm getting goosebumps thinking about it, going to being on the gallops in the sunshine, watching, oh yeah, that's Lompress. Yeah, just pottering up the hill. That, if someone goes to see that, they're in racing for life. And if you get them in when they're 10, 11, 12, 13, and they see that, that's how you get young people into racing, is you just go, here are the horses, here are the stables. And that's the joy of that. So I create content for that. I do stuff with Ollie Bell. And we do various bits and bobs. And it's just trying to get that experience of being an owner in a big yard, but for 40, 50 quid or whatever. And there's a percentage profit built into it, but that's because it's a business. And I don't think people understand how much work goes in to organising this stuff behind the scenes. And people will say, oh yeah, but this, that and the other. And it's like, there's less profit built into this than going to buy a coffee. And you're getting a great this sounds like a promo, but it's genuinely, it's just lovely to meet other people having a good time, because so often you're, especially in this, it's people, you know, saying you tip me a loser, or you know, I can't believe this odds on shot's got beat.
Right, talking about people, characters in the racing game is never short of them.
Yeah.
Tell us about Fatty Folks, the England goalkeeper, and Billy Folks, the Sheffield gambler. And we've got about 10 minutes left.
All right, great. Okay, right, let's rattle through this. Right, so I didn't know this when I got into it, when I got into racing and betting. My family kind of snuck this in years later. They went, oh, by the way, your nan's brother was a gambler. And I was like, all right. And he's like, yeah. And that, he used to own that flat. He was one of the first ones to buy one of those new flats up there. And I'm like, you've never told me this. I've worked in racing and betting for like 5, 6, 7 years. You've never brought this up. And apparently, yeah, my nan's brother, Billy Folks, was like a proper one, you know, one of the faces in the ring. And people, when I wrote that in a column in the Racing Post, and people were messaging me on Twitter saying, God, yeah, I know Billy. Like, we don't see his like around anymore. I never actually met him because he must have passed away, or I must have been very young. But yeah, he was apparently like a proper punter. Like I said, my nan used to say, you know, rich 1 minute, poor the next. That kind of...
Variance.
What's that?
Variance.
Yeah, exactly that. Yeah, yeah. But yeah, you know, I remember... Can I tell... I probably can tell this story.
If he's dead, you can tell the story.
Yeah, that's true. I just remember my nan and my mum saying that he apparently was playing away from his partner once, and he came back to the flat and found that she'd set fire to the curtains, melted all his records, and glued all the locks up. That's the story I remember about him. But apparently he was a very good punter. So it obviously runs in the blood. I just didn't know it.
We better move on to Fatty Folks.
Yeah. Well, so he is officially the heaviest footballer to ever play professional football. There's footage of him on YouTube from sort of 1901, 1902, and it is phenomenal. And he is like... So there was an unveiling of a plaque in at Blackwell Colliery last week. I couldn't go because of bloody sinusitis. But he was like, yeah, proper legend of the game, couple of caps, the only player to ever swing off a crossbar and break it mid-match. Apparently, lore goes that he invented ball boys because they put two boys next to the goal to make him look even bigger when strikers were through on goal. And while they were there, he was like, can you go and get the ball for me? And then people were like, we should do this. But then afterwards, he ran a pub. He was a county cricketer as well. And apparently he used to... take a few bets on the side as well. But yeah, like I said, it's obviously in the blood. I've often wondered how I latched onto this, but it was obviously genetic.
Now then, moving swiftly on again, you said that you were a stand-up comedian. Mm. Or, well, I suppose you always are a stand-up comedian. You were at the Edinburgh Fringe even.
Yeah, I did. I've done 2 years. I did two shows in 1 year, which was the stupidest thing I've ever done. And then I had to have pretty much a month sat down in a darkened room after that. We did a show, me and my friend Josh did a show called The Not So Late Show, which is like a comedy. My dream was always to be Vic and Bob when I was a kid. I always wanted to be Reese and Mortimer. And actually the reason I'm sat here talking to you now is that we did a video called UK Garage Horse Racing.
That was actually on Twitter yesterday. Somebody was tweeted it. It's about 8 years old, is it?
It's still going, yeah. We still don't get credit for it.
Yeah.
We uploaded it at 10 o'clock in the morning, went to get a cup of coffee, came back, and the computer crashed because we've got so many notifications. Someone stole it, put it on their Facebook page, got millions of followers. No one knows it's us. Yeah. Everyone goes, you did that. Someone once showed it to me and went, have you seen this? And I'm like, yeah, I made it. And they're like, what? But yeah, so we did comedy, and then I did a show about betting and gambling as well called Accumulator back in 2018. Again, it's amazing when you do that. I did that at Edinburgh every day. Some of the people that came to our professional poker players, professional poker, what's his name? Keith the Camel. What's his name? Can't remember his surname.
He's just called Keith the Camel, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. Yeah. He came in and you know, you'd meet people who'd come in and talk about it. And yeah, I don't know. It was really interesting doing jokes about that kind of stuff, because it's not something anyone else really... There's one of the comedians, a guy called Ken Cheng, who's a professional poker player and a comedian, but he doesn't do jokes about it. And in hindsight, yeah, it was quite the experience.
Right. This is going to be... You I'm not rushing you here, but
I'm
going to get this bit in.
Crack on.
You firmly believe, you mentioned, you touched on it earlier, about you firmly believe that racing is missing a massive trick with online engagement. So can you... You said they're a decade behind other sports. I know you said we should be doing more things like this, so luckily we've stolen a march. But what do you think racing could and should do that they aren't doing at the moment?
So there's a few things I think people miss, right? So YouTube, I think people still think is like a kid's platform where people are doing beauty reviews or whatever. It's a full-blown media. And the Racing Post do some fantastic shows on it. And everyone now, since lockdown in particular, was like, we need to get a YouTube show. But we should be doing, there should be, if you're into racing, you should be able to watch a stream at any point where we should be able to watch the racing, you should be able to interact with people. There should be podcasts, there should be video podcasts, there should be live streams, there should be stable visits. You should, the mystique around horse racing and betting and stables and trainers and jockeys, it's getting a lot better now, and people are making some fantastic stuff. There's some really, really good stuff. But it should be the bedrock of getting people into it, because people are working from home nowadays. That audience is there. Right now, we could do a live stream with the kind of graphics that they were using on TV 10 years ago, and it would take us 10 minutes to set up, and after a while, you get thousands of people watching. You should be doing that. That's how you convert people into it. You get people to watch it. Community. Don't read the comments and all this is nonsense. You should be encouraging people to comment, and you should be replying to them. This is build a community. Make people think or feel that they're part of the game. There's still a barrier between horse racing and people who are into horse racing. And it's still a bit like, oh, we want you to get into racing, but we want you to get into racing in our way. And you can't really cross that barrier. We know what we're doing. And that's not online. It has broken down those barriers now in all sorts of other sports. And there should be millions and millions of people watching and interacting with horse racing content and getting involved and feeling like they're there after their own. And you should be teaching. This is the other big thing as well that I hate about it. You're expected to know what a speed figure is. You're expected to know what a handicap rating is. You're expected to know what's the difference between 7 furlongs and 10 furlongs.
Even what a furlong is.
Even what a furlong is, exactly. When you actually dig into it, I say, so again, we have a joke with my missus, and I'm like, what are you doing today? She's like, you know, I've got a lot of meetings. And I'm like, yeah, me too. There's 5 on, Sandown's the big one. And there's all this stuff, and even those things, people... She'll watch me sometimes doing a show just to check, you know, that I haven't died or whatever. And she'll go, I didn't understand a single word you were saying. Where is that online resource that if you want to get into the game, you go on and you can learn? It's an open goal because it's so easy to make and you just have to press upload afterwards. And I think we're missing the trick.
Well, hopefully somebody's watching this from the BHA Ross and they'll get on that. Anyway, thanks for your time, Ross Brierley. Thank you very much.
Anytime, mate.